School Leadership Podcast from NAHT Edge and NAHT.
Hello and Happy New Year. Welcome to the latest School Leadership Podcast brought to you as ever by NAHT Edge and NAHT. In this first episode of 2017, we find out more about comparative judgment. It's an alternative way of assessing pupils' writing and ask whether it could form part of a long-term solution when it comes to primary assessment. We also have an early years update for you from the NAHT team with some positive news on funding.
This is the School Leadership Podcast.
Now, comparative judgment is an alternative method for assessing pupils' writing that's gaining considerable interest from within the profession. To find out more about what comparative judgment is and how it works in practice, NAHT Edge Director James Bowen went to speak with Daisy Christodoulou. Daisy is the head of assessment at ARC Schools and has been a strong advocate of this approach.
You've been quite sort of critical of last year's interim framework for assessing writing, and I think a lot of people have been quite critical of that. But what I'm quite interested in, I think your criticism has gone beyond just last year's framework, and you've been quite critical of kind of using criteria-based assessment in general for writing. Can you just sort of explain to me what it is, where your criticisms are based for that?
Absolutely, yeah. So I have been critical of that descriptor-based approach to assessment, I think for a couple of reasons. I think that descriptors, it's very hard to frame them. In fact, I say it's impossible to frame them in such a way that they give you real precision and real accuracy. So inevitably, whatever you do, they end up being quite vague and being capable of interpreted in a number of different ways. And that's true, actually, if they're used for teacher assessment. But even when they're used in more formal forms of assessment, when they're used for exam boards, that's still the risk that you have there. So whenever you mark a piece of work using descriptors, it's very, very hard to get agreement, not just across lots of different teachers, but even just for one teacher to mark a set of scripts using a descriptor. The idea that they would, you know, get that that they would judge them using that descriptor in a way that they might then come back the next day and agree with, even just to get that is very hard. So I think the descriptors, the problem is that they're very vague. And let me give you a concrete example of that. Even in subjects like maths, it's really hard to frame them in that precise way. So a couple of my favourite examples of this is that, let's say you have a statement that says, can compare two fractions to see which is larger. And you'd think, well, that's surely really precise.
It seems like the kind of thing that you could either say yes or no.
Absolutely.
Right or wrong.
And you can see how you think as a teacher, right, I'm going to rag rate that, red, amber, green. I'm going to say, can my class compare two fractions to see which is larger? But what it turns out is when you define that, the way you define that question has an enormous impact on the number of pupils who get it right or wrong. So if you ask pupils what's bigger, 3/7 or 5/7, about 90% of them get that right. If you ask them what's bigger, 3/4 or 2/3, about 75% get it right. If you ask them what's bigger, 5/7 or 5/9, only about 15% get it right. So what you're seeing is all those questions are completely legitimate interpretations of the descriptor. But what really matters is which one you pick, because one will tell you that your class are on track, doing absolutely fine, doing brilliantly. The other one will tell you that the same class are falling horribly behind and need urgent help. So it all depends on how you define the descriptor. So another really even simpler example, if you're saying, can a pupil add two numbers fluently in their head? If you ask 8-year-olds what's 11 plus 3, most of them will get that right, 11 plus 3. If you ask them what's 3 plus 11, many fewer get it right. And I can see you nodding there because I can see you thinking of a typical 8-year-old.
I've experienced that myself.
And you can
yeah.
see them with yeah. 11 plus 3. Yeah. They've got their hands out in front and they're going 11, 12, 13, 14.
Yes.
They've got 3 plus 11, they're going 3, 4, 5, 6, and all of a sudden they're running out of fingers. So even just reversing the order of the numbers in a sum makes that question all the harder. And if you think that's true of something like maths, which is relatively objective and precise, think how much more true that is of a subject like English, of things like writing, of when you're saying can vary clauses to create an effect or can create suspense in a narrative. Think how much harder it is to use those and how much more subjectivity there is there. So I think the issue with descriptors and criteria is they're so hard to interpret reliably.
For years and years we've been using that, does that sort of raise questions around the reliability of the data that's being produced by those kind of descriptor-based assessments that we've been used to doing?
Yes, I would say it definitely does. And I would say that in the past, it's always been offset by the fact that for maths and reading, you've had also had tests, which have helped you, I think, to calibrate the judgment. But I think in the case of writing, even when there were tests back in the day, when there were externally marked tests, those tests were still being marked using rubrics. And I'm not pretending that when we had tests, things were better than the situation we had now. And I think when you talk to head teachers who were teaching then, they would say they were very unhappy with the reliability of a lot of those assessments. So I think that there's, when you use descriptors like that, I think you do have huge issues in getting reliable judgments. And reliability can sometimes seem like a bit of a pedantic concern. You know, hang on, does it really matter? As long as we're rewarding pupils for their effort and we understand that they're doing good writing. But reliability really does matter, because it's a difference between a child getting a child's mark really differing quite dramatically over time. It's the difference between thinking a pupil is really working below the standard and actually they could be working above it.
And actually, from a school's perspective, reliability really matters. When head teachers know that there's such pressure on those results, you need to know that the result your school's getting is comparable to a different school.
Absolutely. And we need to know that they are nationally comparable and comparable between schools. And again, as you say, so much pressure is placed on these assessments that I think it's quite right for schools and teachers and head teachers to say, well, if you're going to put that pressure on them and for that accountability, we need to be sure that what we're looking at is reliable. So I think the reliability issue is a really big one. And I think often when you sort of say to teachers the reliability you get from descriptor-based assessment, they're quite surprised by how low it is. So again, without getting too technical, you get reliability, the traditional sort of form of reliability you get for this kind of descriptor-based assessment. Most of the research studies that have been done on it show that it's about sort of 0.4, 0.5 for that kind of assessment. And that's really low. That is not giving you the security or the certainty that a pupil's assessment, if it was marked by another teacher or indeed the same teacher at a different time or by another marker or someone in another school, you don't have very much confidence that they will be getting the same grade.
So if we've established that it's a huge issue of reliability with sort of descriptor-based judgments. Obviously, you've been working on something called comparative judgment. Yeah. It would be really useful if you could explain how comparative judgment works. And what I'm quite keen is, there'll be people listening who have never heard of it, have no idea what it is, how it works. Yeah. So kind of really an overview of what it is. Yeah. And perhaps for teachers, what it would look like and what it would feel like for them using it, if that's possible.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll give a bit of an overview, if you like, a little bit of the history of it, and then I'll talk about how you use it for writing, what it looks like in practice. So the history of it, it's based on an algorithm, I think, that was first come up with in the 1920s. So in some ways, it's got quite an old history. And how it works on it, it works on the theory that as human beings, we're really bad at making absolute judgments. That's not a thing to do with teachers. It's not a thing to do with primary writing. It's that in any field you care to look at, human beings are generally not very good at saying, here's a thing, can I rate it against an absolute standard of judgment? And there's all kinds of interesting things on this. If you try and give somebody a colour and try and get them to grade it, if you like, on a scale of light blue to dark blue, if you give them a shade of blue and say how blue it is, if they're doing it absolutely, it's really, really hard. But whilst humans are bad at absolute judgments, they're really good at relative judgments or comparative judgments. So if you give people two shades of blue and say which one's darker, they can do that much more easily. And that this is the principle that sits behind this marking of writing. And in fact, to see that colours example, that blue example, you can do a little experiment with that. You can go on to the No More Marking website. And No More Marking is the name of the organisation who offer this comparative judgment service for free. And if you go on there, they've got a little demo which involves playing with colours, and so you can see that. But how it works in terms of assessing writing then is that your traditional way of marking writing is absolute. You've got your criteria, say your interim framework, and you've got your essay, your script or your piece of writing. And you take your piece of writing, you take your interim framework, and you're thinking, right, absolutely, which category does it best fit into, or how many of these things did it tick off? And that's very, very hard to do reliably, and that's not to do with teachers not being good at it or whether they need more training. It's just a thing that human beings find tough. And what comparative judgment says is, right, instead of doing that, scan in your scripts, scan them in onto a computer, and you upload them to, in this case I'm saying, the No More Marking website. So No More Marking provides this service. So you scan your scripts into the No More Marking website, and they appear on your screen two at a time. So you see two pop up next to each other, one on the left, one on the right. And all you have to do as a teacher, as a marker, you have to read them both and say which one you think is the better piece of writing. So there's no rubric, there's no criteria, you just say which is the better piece of writing. You are really making a holistic judgment. And you, it's okay to go with your gut instinct. You can make that call. So you look at the two and you say, this is the better piece of writing. And you do lots of judgments like that, and it's not just you doing them, you have colleagues doing it too, potentially colleagues in your school, could be people outside your school. And then what the comparative judgment engine does, the No More Marking this software offers, is the algorithm sitting behind the system crunches all your decisions, and it works out a score for each script based on all of those judgments. So it aggregates hundreds, maybe thousands of judgments, and uses them to award each script a score. And so what you then get back as a teacher is you get a score, which then you can convert into a scaled score or a grade for all of the scripts that were in the pot. So that's the broad summary of how it works. So instead of you looking at one script, marking it against a framework, you're seeing two pop up on the screen, you're saying which one is better, and the algorithm's doing the hard work of creating a grade from that.
And I'd imagine, yeah, people listening might sort of think, well, hang on a minute, this sounds very simplistic. Mm. So, you know, I'm used to going through and I'm looking at a list of criteria, I'm looking at grammar, I'm looking at overall purpose, let's take the writing framework this year, which perhaps wasn't very well designed, but a well designed one, I can take all those things into account, like a really sharp judgment. This just sounds like, you know, which one's better? Sounds very simplistic. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, well, it does sound simplistic. And I must say, when I first heard of it, that's exactly what I thought. And I think the really interesting thing is you need to give it a go. Give it a go and look at the results you get. And I think the other thing that it feels crazy about it is much simpler and much quicker and much easier to do than traditional moderation. So it feels like it shouldn't be giving you accurate results. It feels like it should be giving you things that aren't very reliable. But the great sort of oddness of it all is that it's giving you a much more reliable measure than that traditional way you outlined of looking at the purpose and the grammar and what have you. So it is odd. I absolutely give you that. But the interesting thing is when you can measure it, and as I say, these studies have been done, and you can see it when you do comparative judgment, that with comparative judgment you get up to reliability very quickly of 0.8, 0.9. I mean, we did a session last week here at ARC, where we had quite a lot of judgments per script, and we got a reliability in one of our sessions of 0.95. And just to put that into context, you know, one would be perfect reliability. One would be, you know, complete agreement. To get 0.95 is incredible. As I say, what you're looking at with a lot of traditional marking is 0.4, 0.5. So I think it is odd. You have this weird situation in which your traditional moderation process feels much more rigorous, but gives you very, very, very unreliable results. Whereas this process, comparative judgment, it saves you so much time. It doesn't take nearly as much time. It's much more enjoyable. It gives you it gives you more reliable results as well.
And kind of from the way you've described it, in some ways, it feels very much like perhaps this is a summative tool. So this is something you would do maybe once at the end of each term. Yeah. It could be used at the end of a key stage for a statutory assessment, but perhaps not something you would use as a formative tool on a day-to-day basis. Is that fair, or could you use it both ways, do you think?
So I think you're right to say that the sort of the primary aim of it, I think, is to do better summative assessment. And I think that the way that it gives you a score for writing, that's what it does. But for me, what is fascinating about it is that it might not directly give you a formative assessment, but indirectly it's going to have, I think, enormous formative power. And what I mean by that is that at the moment we are using the same tool, the interim frameworks. We use those both summatively and formatively. So we're using the interim frameworks to make a summative judgment about where a piece of writing or a pupil's writing lies, and we're also using it as a formative tool to guide our teaching. And actually, I've explained why the interim frameworks and rubrics don't do a good job summatively. They don't do a very good job formatively either, because they've been designed with this summative purpose in mind. They're not very specific. They're quite vague. So when they're used as lesson objectives, they don't often hone into that level of specificity that you really need to help pupils improve. So I think what for me is really interesting is that comparative judgment offers you a way to open up the space to do formative assessment differently. And it opens up a space for you to say, if something isn't on the rubric, or if we think the rubric isn't quite expressing this in the same way, we don't have to do it like this. So let me give you a concrete example of what I mean. One of my favourite examples is to do with fronted adverbials. So fronted adverbials are something that's often, I think they're on the old APP, they're mentioned on the new interim framework, so in the curriculum, and they're one of those things that people sort of look out for to spot. And if you see the fronted adverbial, you go tick, they've got a fronted adverbial, that's bumping them up, it's giving them points. And I don't want to knock front-end adverbials. They do matter and they do help, and pupils should know how to use them. But again, I think we've all been in that situation where you see a pupil who's used their front-end adverbials very reliably, but it's not a great piece of writing. And you have another pupil who hasn't used any, but it's a better piece of writing. What do you do there? And should you be using, therefore, should you be structuring lessons around the use of front-end adverbials? Well, maybe, but perhaps not. Perhaps there are other things which help you to be a good writer, which we should be focusing on, which are harder to express in a rubric, but which matter just as much. So what comparative judgment allows you to do is it allows you to focus really on the holistic quality of a piece of work, that you are making a judgment about the overall quality of it, rather than these kind of quite disembodied elements on the rubric. So I think because of that, because comparative judgment rewards genuine quality, I think that it will indirectly have an enormous impact on teaching and learning and formative assessment, and it opens up a space to actually teach in a way that is much more conducive to the development of good writing. And actually that's the reason I'm most excited about it. So I think comparative judgment has huge benefits for reliability, has huge benefits in reducing workload, which are really important, and those are the quick wins, if you like. But almost the thing I'm most excited about is how it could transform our understanding of what good writing is and how we become good writers.
And I suppose, yeah, what some of the biggest criticisms around Secure Fit has been that the way it's kind of distorted teaching, where people have felt, I've got to teach a series of lessons on semicolons and get children to shoehorn in just so I can tick that box. And I suppose you would argue that comparative judgment would mean you could stop doing that and just focus on creating good writers, which may include semicolons at the right point, but not just to tick a box. Is that a fair...
I think that's absolutely right. And this is not at all about saying semicolons aren't important or front-end adverbials aren't important. Of course they're important. But of course we also know, and we know this because primary teachers up and down the country are telling us it, we've seen, you know, I think Michael Tidd's written really well about this, about some of the problems you've got, is that this tick box writing is causing big problems with the way writing's being taught. And the front-end adverbial example is a good one. I mean, my favourite example of this is a pupil writing, forgettably, he crept through the darkness. So they've used front-end adverbial, tick, you get the front-end adverbial, but actually, does it make sense? And whenever I say that to people, that sentence, they say, oh, maybe in a sort of postmodern way, it's quite... and potentially it is. Potentially it's a beautiful sentence, but I think ultimately it's the people who sort of shoehorned in the front-end adverbial for the sake of it. I think there's lots of stories about people using recipes to get the passive voice in or what have you, various sort of different things that people are doing to get certain modes of writing. And actually, we know that doesn't create a good writer. And in the big trial that we did with last summer with Dr. Chris Whedon of No More Marking, we looked at 256 pieces of pupil work across 5 different schools. And we found some really fascinating examples of where exactly this was happening. So we found one in particular, which is on Chris's website. But there was one pupil who had written something that was really lovely and very beautifully written, and which our comparative judgment judges felt was really good and got a high score. And we found another piece that was much more mechanical and had got a lower score on the comparative judgment. But in the local authority moderation, it was the other way around. And the piece that we all thought was very good, felt was very good, had actually been given working towards. And that was because the spelling in it, there were quite a few spelling errors, so it hadn't hit that box. So as you say, the secure fit meant that even though this was a really lively and interesting piece of writing, some spelling errors had meant that it was pulled down. The more mechanical piece was not nearly as interesting to read, not nearly really as coherent, but it was given a higher mark because it had ticked a lot of boxes. And I think the problem is we don't want to be incentivising, I think, that kind of behaviour. And I think the worrying thing for me about the secure fit approach, I understand why secure fit was brought in. I think secure fit was brought in to address some of the problems of the vagueness maybe around best fit, but secure fit is just causing a whole other lot of problems. And the problem with secure fit is that when you apply a secure fit rubric to an open task, it isn't fair. So what I mean by that is writing's an open task. Each child responds to the piece in their own way. So one child, and in the case of this example I'm giving, this child had chosen to write a piece of writing about Mars, and she told us that Mars was that the ancient Egyptians felt certain things about Mars. And she'd misspelled ancient in Egyptian. The child who had got the expected standard, he'd got the tick for spelling, but he hadn't tried to spell ancient. He hadn't tried to spell Egyptian. Could he have spelled ancient or Egyptian? We don't know. So what I'm saying is that's not a fair assessment. So the secure fit, if you're using secure fit statements like must spell most words correctly, it's not fair to apply that to a task where pupils can respond in different ways. So that's what's causing a lot of the problems as well.
And I want to ask now, how and if this could fit within our sort of statutory assessment framework. Obviously, we've kind of lots of people asking questions about that at the moment. We had the Education Select Committee. We're about to embark on a consultation around statutory assessment. So I suppose the question to ask is, could comparative judgment form part of a future vision for that? And, you know, could it work alongside the existing reading and maths tests? You know, we talked about scaled scores. Could it work like that? Could we literally take out the current secure fit model and drop comparative judgment in instead, and it would work as a sort of holistic solution?
I think there's definitely a role for comparative judgment in national assessments. I think that anything new, and this would be very new, obviously you have to give it time and pilot things really carefully and think about things really carefully. For me, I think the best way to do that would be if the frameworks that we have at the minute, if they could be moved to a best fit model. You could carry on with statutory assessment as it is, but it would give teachers and local authorities and academy chains a bit more scope to use evidence from comparative judgment in the evidence they bring to local authorities. So at the minute, we could still do a comparative judgment process and take that to local authorities as evidence. The problem would be that they would say, well, if we're this secure fit model, this pupil may have come out very well on the comparative judgment, but they're not hitting this statement on the rubric, and that would be true. I think if you move to a best fit model, if you just kept the frameworks as they are but moved them best fit, that would give teachers who wanted to and schools who wanted to the opportunity to run their own internal comparative judgment sessions and take those as evidence to local authority. And that would be a way for teachers and for the sector to develop a bit more expertise in using this.
So comparative judgment effectively supporting a best fit approach to assessing writing. So the two almost running sort of in parallel, supporting each other. Is that a
Absolutely.
Reason?
And I think that's a short-term thing that you could introduce that wouldn't bring in too much upheaval. And I am aware, as much as anyone is, of all the upheaval there has been. So I think that this is something you could introduce really quickly, really simply, that would allow teachers who are interested in this and have an idea of how it works to start using it in their own schools and bringing it forward as evidence. And then what would happen if that worked well, and if people were like that and were getting to grips with it and it felt like the way forward, then potentially, perhaps in a few years' time, you could see something more developing from that, and you could see perhaps reform of the frameworks completely or something else happening with those. But I think in the short term, something that would really help would be for the frameworks to go best fit. And you're right, then those would sort of, the comparative judgment and the current best fit process could run alongside each other.
And a question that kind of springs to mind at this point is, from what we've talked about so far, I think you'd get the impression that it's judging individual pieces of writing. So child A piece of writing here, child B piece of writing here, as opposed to judging portfolios. And I suppose the criticism around that would be, under existing or previous ways of assessing writing, we've been able to look at narrative, non-fiction, poetry, even, look at a range of a child's writing rather than just basing it on a one-off piece. Can that fit into comparative judgment, or does it have to be based on one-off pieces?
So that was the question, or one of the questions, we wanted to explore in the pilot we did last summer. So all our initial trials with comparative judgment we'd done with just one piece, and that was the question we were getting from a lot of primary teachers: but can you use this for portfolios, and can you use it to, we don't just want it to be one piece of writing but several. So one of the things we did in our pilot last summer with the 256 pupils is we didn't just take in one piece, we took in a small portfolio, but a portfolio of three pieces. And one of our research questions was, will we still get these high levels of reliability? Will it be much harder for people to judge? So I haven't mentioned yet that just how quick a lot of these judgments are. We find we can get really high levels of reliability with people making judgments on scripts, and they can make those judgments very quickly. That's why the system is so efficient, that you can make quite a reliable judgment on scripts in 20 or 30 seconds. And that feels odd and feels wrong, but it, as I say, it's possible. And one of the things we thought was, well, will it be slower to be making the judgment on portfolios, and will it be as reliable if you've got variation in quality between the pieces? And what we found after we did that is we found that the reliability was still very high. So I think in every session we ran, and we ran five individual school sessions and a central one, we were getting reliability of over 0.85. So it might have been down by a fraction from the studies with just one piece, but it was still very, very high and still in excess of what you get elsewhere. So the reliability was great. And the time, it did take a bit longer for people to make those judgments, but again, a bit longer, but still far more efficient than the current method. So it definitely can be done using portfolios. I would say probably the most time-consuming thing with a portfolio is you do have to think about how pupils write things and how you get them scanned in, that side of things. And it probably is a lot easier if they've just written one thing on one piece of paper to get that scanned in and uploaded. Once you start getting quite big portfolios, you do have an administrative issue around getting everything scanned in. So I think it does become a bit more time consuming and a bit less efficient when you're using big portfolios, but it still works and it's still more efficient and less time consuming than the current model.
And I'm interested in the kind of impact on workload, because you've touched on that, and I've heard you sort of speak before about, yeah, particularly around the moderation process, where you'll explain this better than I will, but you were saying about, you know, how teachers, it can take teachers an awful long time to moderate just one piece of, or one child's sort of portfolio at a time, whereas comparative judgment seems to speed that up an awful lot. Would that be a fair...
Absolutely. So I think, as I say, in the short term, the biggest gains you get from comparative judgment are on workload and reliability. And the workload is astonishing. So I remember the very first trial we did here, when I didn't know as much about it as I do now, and we were just trying to find our way, one of my secondary colleagues came to we ran a primary session, but a secondary colleague came along. And at the end of it, she said, "This is unbelievable." She said, "We've got to a point in half an hour. It normally takes us 6 hours to get to this point, and everybody's fallen out." She says, "We've got to the same point in half an hour, and nobody's even spoken." She said, "So now we can just go down the pub for 5.5 hours.
Which is going to be welcomed by everybody.
Yeah, right. Bringing you more time in the pub. Yeah. Yeah. So I think there is a huge, huge benefit to be had there. And I think, yes, the reason why it is more efficient is because it is just playing to our strengths, if you like, as human beings, that we're better at relative judgment. It's using the power of technology. So I think one of the things is, whilst the algorithm that sits behind comparative judgment has been around for a long time, the software and the sort of computing power that allow those algorithms to be crunched really quickly in real time haven't been around as long. So I think some of the first trials with comparative judgment, they always, I think back in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, which were done at university, they had to be, I think the calculations all had to be crunched manually. And that adds a lot of time. But you don't have to do that now. This all happens. If you use no more marking, it is happening pretty much in real time. So you can just get those results straight away. So that speeds things up brilliantly. So that's where you can get those really quick judgments. You can make those judgments instinctively very quickly. The other thing you can do, a couple of other things which help with time, is it can feel sometimes, as I say, a bit like you're only looking at a piece for 30 seconds. How can that be right? But what you've got to remember is it's not just you looking at the piece. It's your colleagues or however many people you've got in that judging session. And what is so amazing is that if you set up a trial to have 10 judgments per script, which is generally what we aim for, every single piece of writing in your pot is being seen 10 times. And how rare is that in a traditional moderation? Actually, if you have 10 judgments per script, it's been seen 20 times. So how rare is that? And I remember doing, I'm a secondary English teacher, and I remember doing coursework moderation. And I was in a school with 300 kids in each year group. And they all wrote 6 pieces. Now, what are the chances of every piece being seen 20 times? It's just not feasible with traditional moderation. But with this method, it is possible for scripts to get seen again and again. And what that means is, because you're aggregating judgments across lots of people, the other concern people have is they say, well, what if someone makes bad judgments? But you have information on the judges and the judgments they're making, and you can see if people are in line, and you can see if there are any outliers, or there are people who are making judgments that are not in line with the group. So you've got that as a safety method too. So you're aggregating so many judgments, and pieces are being seen again and again and again. So you can have much more confidence in traditional moderation, and yet it's still a lot speedier.
And I want to put to you perhaps like a challenge, if you like. I've heard that some people have heard about comparative judgment. One of the things they'll say, look, the problem with it, this leads to us effectively ranking children. That what will happen each year is we'll have a national cohort, and we'll effectively be ranking them from one to however many in order. And people are kind of uncomfortable with that idea, that this leads to sort of a ranking approach.
So I think, when you're explaining comparative judgment for the first time, I sometimes sort of quite lazily can talk about it as being about ranking pupils. But actually, that is very simplistic. It is far more sophisticated than that. It's a very sophisticated measurement system, which actually allows you to measure performance across time. So with the teachers I've spoken to, actually one of the things they find so powerful, potentially powerful about its use, is that it allows you to measure progress in writing over time in a way that has just not been possible to do accurately before. So one colleague said to me that he has a boy, an EAL child, who's made enormous progress in writing over a period of about 6 months, but that would not be picked up on the interim frameworks because they're so blunt and there's only 3 categories. So he's made this enormous progress, but the teacher can't sort of show to him, if you like, concretely how that's happened. Comparative judgment, because it assigns you a score, would allow you to show that progress. It would allow you to say, look, this is where you were in September, but you've made this huge improvement to, by the time you've reached February or Easter. And that is something that traditional methods of marking writing don't allow you to do, to be able to show you that kind of much more fine-grained progress over time. So I think that it's more about, it's a sophisticated measurement process which allows you to assign pupils a score. So it isn't about just saying to a child, you're 15th out of 30 in the class. It is about saying, here's your score at this moment in time, and we can follow up with you again and we can see if your score has improved. And as I say, we're only just getting to that point now in the trials we're doing, but that's enormously powerful.
At the moment, it's working, I guess, on a relatively small scale. So from what I understand, relatively small scale studies. Could this work nationally? And are there barriers that would need to be overcome? You know, could you see this something, if we're talking about it potentially being a solution for statutory assessment, it would need to work at a national level?
Yes, that's a good question. And you're right, a lot of the studies we've done here have been quite small scale. Even the one we did last summer only had 256 pupils in. But again, one of the things we did with the trial last summer is to start to think about ways that you could scale this up. And is there a way that you could have lots of small-scale judging sessions going on, but that you could link them? So the idea would be is that you wouldn't have one giant big session with 500,000 pupil scripts in.
I suppose what people imagine, one central ranking absolutely. Database everyone's feeding
that,
into.
You can imagine that, you know, I'm not going to pretend to be the technical expert here, but you can imagine that would be enormously complex. What we did... were trying to investigate in the study we did last summer was, could you have individual school sessions? So a school and their teachers judge their child's own script, their children's own scripts, and could you then take forward a percentage of scripts from each school and put those into a central pot, and then based on that central judging, then apply those standards back? And that process is sort of pretty much called anchoring, that you're trying to anchor everything onto a consistent scale. And again, that was something we found we did make work, and it could work. And we found, interestingly as well, again, one of the most fascinating things about it is we have 5 individual schools all doing their own judging. And we found that there were really good, not only was there really good reliability within each session, but there was very good reliability between those 5 individual sessions and the central session, which we took forward 20% of the scripts from each individual school. So we found that the judgments that teachers from one school were making about a script, if you like, were really similar to the judgment teachers were making from another school, even though those teachers had never met, they were in different local authorities, that they were making consistent judgments. And again, I think that is the beauty of comparative judgment, because it is asking you about holistic quality of writing. It does seem to be that there is something that we all recognise as good writing, even if we can't capture it in a rubric. And that's what we were finding. So I think it could work at a big scale, and it would work such that you could have individual teachers doing their own judging and then percentages of pieces of work coming forward in like a tiered way. So I could imagine sort of every school doing their own judgment and then maybe coming up at a regional level and then coming up at a national level and then those standards being applied down so that everything is on a consistent scale. I think if you did it at that level, that's what you'd be looking at. I think that's something you obviously have to be developed and have to think about. I think for me, the interesting thing at the moment is how can, you know, if there's a school who's just interested in using this and want to give it a go and see how their year 6 work is shaping up, No More Marking are currently running a bigger pilot, a bit like the one that we did last year, but it's a slightly bigger pilot, which is going to, in this case, be completed before year 6 local authority moderation. So if schools are interested in taking part in that, they will get evidence on how their pupils have done compared to a really big sample. They will get evidence from that before local authority moderation, and they'll be able to take that evidence forward to local authority moderation and indeed use what they've learned from that to help their children. So I think in the longer term there's a way you could do a bigger thing. I think if you're interested in it at the moment and think, what can I do with it now to help me with this, there's something you can get involved with right away.
Teaching. Leadership. And the latest developments in schools.
Time now for an early years funding update from Head of Policy Valentine Mulholland, who is joined by Edge Director James Bowen. Valentine started by outlining some of the key funding issues that are facing the sector.
The big issue for us for a long time has been the inconsistency across the country of funding and the way that local authorities were funded and then passed that funding on to early years providers has led to a situation where we've got some settings offering exactly the same kind of provision, getting £3 an hour, and others getting £7 an hour. And what's fundamentally wrong with that is the children who are receiving the education that can be paid for out of that. So we've made the case for a long time that there needs to be a national funding formula. The government decided that this was a priority when they announced, when the new government, the last government came in, that they would be extending 30 hours of free childcare to all the children of working parents. And they weren't going to be able to make anybody offer those free childcare hours. So it needed to be attractive enough that providers, both in schools and in private nurseries, would be prepared to deliver that. And it was clear at that point that the funding was inadequate. So the government undertook a full review of the funding for childcare, made a commitment to increase the level of funding nationally anyway, but also to look at how it's allocated. We were very keen to feed into that. We carried out a survey of our members, which really highlighted the enormous inconsistencies. And also that in the case of schools anyway, about 80% of providers were having to subsidise their early years provision from the rest of the school budget. And when we know that the school budget's really already under enormous pressure, then that's not going to be sustainable.
So what was contained within the government's original proposals for a national funding formula?
So the original proposals were that there would be one rate for all providers of early years education, so both private nurseries and provision in primary schools, and that for the first 2 years only there would be additional funding for maintained nursery schools, but after that it was assumed that they would continue, that they would get that lower rate, which would be totally unsustainable. The reasoning behind there being a common rate between nursery classes in primary schools and private nurseries was the fact that when the Department for Education have looked at the cost of providing childcare and early years education, they found that although private nurseries have got lower staffing costs because they've got less qualified staff, they've got much bigger fixed costs because they're just running that nursery, where the primary school has got a much bigger establishment. But of course, maintained nursery schools have the higher qualified staff and don't have the economies of scale because they're a much bigger school. So they were losing out in both ways.
We had some serious concerns about the original proposals as outlined in the consultation. What were these?
I think Valentine's alluded to some of these already. Our main concern really was the impact this was going to have on maintained nursery schools. When we looked at sort of the consultation, looked at the figures involved, it became clear quite early on really that there was going to be a genuine threat to the future of some of the maintained nursery schools, because it wasn't taking account of the additional costs in terms of particularly around staffing, but also fixed costs. We know maintained nursery schools are expensive to run. And when we looked at it, there was a genuine threat that these nursery schools wouldn't be able to continue on that basis. And that was a real concern, mainly because actually what a good job they do for children. You know, they get particularly good outcomes and they're disproportionately placed in some of our most disadvantaged areas of the country. So they're doing a really important job in terms of the early years in that part of the sector. So we were hugely concerned that they may cease to exist based on that formula. So we ran a really sort of strong campaign trying to get the message across to government about the risks involved, and Valentine led that, and there was quite a lot of press coverage. So yeah, we've been really quite clear that was a troubling part of the consultation.
And the other thing we were a bit worried about as well was the fact that currently local authorities can pay an additional supplement to providers who've got high qualified staff, so who've got early years teachers. And that quality supplement, although there's going to be a number of voluntary supplements that local authorities can still pay, and that was no longer going to be one. So we felt that actually we were going to have this encouragement to more childcare, but actually potentially at a lower quality. So that was also quite a big concern. So we made the case that quality supplement should be retained.
There's been some very positive news since our original response. What have the government said?
Basically, they've accepted both those points that we've been campaigning on. So they've made a commitment that the additional funding, which is £56 million a year, for maintained nursery schools will continue until the end of the comprehensive spending review, which is 2020. And obviously they can't really make a firm commitment beyond that period because it could be a different government. And they've also retained the voluntary quality factor. So we would hope that a lot of local authorities will continue to use that to encourage providers to have better qualified staff. And the NHT is really, really clear that the best outcomes for early years of education are where it's led by teachers, and where it's early years education rather than just childcare.
So before we leave you this month, there's just time to tell you about one of our upcoming conference events. This month's featured course is on Assessment in Practice. This is a one-day course running in London on the 18th of May. You'll develop the skills to lead outstanding assessment in your school and to support teachers in putting these skills into practice. You'll gain the knowledge to support teachers in understanding how each assessment method contributes to and builds on current practice to maximise the effectiveness of school improvement. You can find out more on this and our other events at www.nht.org.uk/events. It's a big thanks from us for listening to this episode of the School Leadership Podcast. NAHT is a professional association and union for school leaders. NAHT Edge is the part of the association aimed specifically at aspirational middle leaders. To discover more about the benefits of being an NAHT Edge or NAHT member, go online to nahtedge.org.uk/join or www.nht.org.uk/join. You can follow us on Twitter at NAHT Edge and at NAHT News. Until next time.